John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, January 14th, 2013. A worker dies in Gaza as a tunnel collapses while Israeli troops arrest 9 civilians from the West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Monday at dawn 9 Palestinians in the West Bank districts of Bethlehem, Jenin, Nablus, Hebron and Jerusalem. Local news sources reported that the army invaded Beit Fajar town in the Bethlehem district, broke into and searched several homes, then kidnapped 2 residents. In Hebron, in the southern part of the West Bank, the soldiers invaded Beit Umar town and kidnapped 3 residents after breaking into and searching their homes. Another civilian was kidnapped from the city of Jenin and one more man from Nablus city. 2 residents were arrested by Israeli troops during home searches in Jerusalem city as well. In other news, the Israeli government published plans for the construction of additional 170 units and 84 guest rooms for Jewish settlers in Rotem illegal settlement in the Jordan Valley, Hagit Ofran of Israel's Peace Now movement reported. Ofran said that the construction has been previously authorized by Israel and that what have been declared recently is the construction plan. Construction maps were submitted last week for review. They include 200 homes in addition to construction plans for 84 guest rooms. Ofran further stated that the Israeli public has 60 days to file objections and that after all objections, if any, have been reviewed, the construction and planning committee will be deciding whether to approve or reject the plan, although rejection is a rare occurrence. Elsewhere on Sunday, Palestinian medical sources in Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip reported that one Palestinian was killed and 3 others were injured when a siege-busting tunnel on the borders with Egypt collapsed on them. The sources said that rescue teams managed to save 3 wounded tunnel workers from under the rubble, while a 4th suffocated before he was rescued. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, January 14th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
Afghanistan, 11th of January. A Spanish soldier was killed by an IED blast in Badghis province. Afghanistan, 10th of January. NATO is reporting the death of an American soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Pakistan, 14th of January. Up to 14 Pakistani soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb in North Waziristan, one day after leadership of the Pakistani Taliban called for an end to such attacks to focus on attacking U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. Pakistan, 10th of January. Drivers of NATO supply trucks have gone on strike, demanding an end to a system requiring them to drive only for major corporate trucking companies, similar to what first D.C. Mayor Fendi and now D.C. Mayor Gray are trying to do to taxi drivers here. The last time these deliveries were stopped, it cost the U.S. and NATO $100 million a month to use an alternate route. Pakistan, 11th of January. 9 oil tanker trucks bound for NATO forces in Afghanistan were blown up by a rocket attack in Balochistan, according to Press TV. 2 people were killed and 3 others were wounded. Nobody has claimed responsibility for the attack. Washington, ongoing. U.S. President Barack Obama, after meeting with Afghan President Karzai, has announced plans to remove all or most U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year. Mr. Barack Obama, why wait until then? You can't change anything on the ground in 1 year dedicated mostly to withdrawal from the war, so why continue to fight? Bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Guantanamo Bay, the name rings with the cries of the tortured. On the 11th of January, 2002, the first prisoners arrived in hell on earth. When they arrived at Guantanamo Bay, they knew that there was a hell. They knew that there was a devil, and his name was George W. Bush. Seven years later, January 2009, newly inaugurated President Obama promised to close this hellhole down, but 4 years later he has not done so. On the 11th of January 2013, hundreds of protesters marched from the Supreme Court to the White House demanding that Guantanamo Bay be closed forever. For each man detained at Guantanamo Bay, one protester wore an orange jumpsuit and a black hood in America's March of Shame.
We've started at the Supreme Court, which is also significant, and we passed the Capitol on the way. And, you know, 4 years ago, President Obama came into office and made an executive order promising to close Guantanamo within a year. That was very much the right and proper thing to do. And he failed to fulfill that promise. And he has been guilty of cowardice himself. He has run up against unprincipled and opportunistic opposition to these plans in the Congress. And the prisoners have encountered opposition from ideologically minded right-wing judges in the DC Circuit Court who have prevented their release and have gutted habeas corpus of all meaning when it comes to their stories.
Shame on them!
They have also run up against the complete indifference of the Supreme Court, which refused to accept appeals from seven of the men in June last year. And one of the men whose appeals they refused to consider was a man called Adnan Latif, a Yemeni man who died at Guantanamo in September. Who died at Guantanamo possibly as many as 8 years, but certainly almost 6 years after he was told that he was not wanted in custody anymore, that he was cleared for release. He died at Guantanamo because he was a Yemeni. And ever since, on Christmas Day 2009, a Nigerian man tried to blow up a bomb in his underwear on a plane bound for the US, and it turned out that he was apparently recruited in Yemen, there has been an absolute ban on releasing any Yemenis from Guantanamo Bay.
With that, here's a section of Adnan Latif's poem titled Hunger Strike Poem. They are artists of torture. They are artists of pain and fatigue. They are artists of insults and humiliation. They do not spare the elderly. They do not spare the baby-toothed child. They leave us in prison for years, uncharged, because we are Muslims. Where is the world to save us from torture? Where is the world to save us from fire and sadness? Where is the world to save the hunger strikers? But we are content on the side of justice and right, worshipping the Almighty. And our motto on this island is Salam. I trust each of you to make sure that Adnan, his friend Mohammed, and the rest of the men at Guantanamo are not forgotten. Thank you.
I'm sorry that we're all here again in 2013. I've been here every year for the past 5 years. But I want to tell two stories today. One is about urgency, and another is about hope. And I'm going to start with urgency. I went to Guantanamo last month to visit a client. His name is Ghalib Al-Bahani. This is his name. He's a young man from Yemen who's been detained without charge since 2002 for 11 years. The government says he was an assistant cook for a group that no longer exists. The D.C. Circuit Court upheld his detention, as they have reflexively in every detainee appeal so far, and the court behind me declined to review his appeal, as they have in every case since they granted the right to detainees to be able to challenge their detention. For that reason, Ghalib Al-Bahani has spent a third of his life in a prison camp on a U.S. military base in Cuba.
At the conclusion of the rally in the Ellipse, with the White House in the backdrop, against the continued existence of that hellhole of a prison at Guantanamo Bay, Amnesty International withdrew from the protest while Witness Against Torture marched on the White House fence for civil disobedience, tying a banner and orange ribbons to the fence. The police did not take the bait, refusing to arrest anybody. On the 12th of January, about 100 protesters against the explosion of drone strikes by the CIA, plus torture and hellholes in CIA black sites at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, blocked the entrance of CIA headquarters from Dolly Madison Avenue in McLean, Virginia.
I guess that's a choice the United States offers those who don't like capitalism: execution by drone or life in prison without trial at Guantanamo Bay.
Caesars don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain.
Reaper drones aren't the only way the United States kills people believed to be opponents of the U.S. government. Military whistleblowers have revealed that three people at Guantanamo Bay who were alleged to have committed suicide all on the same day after being cleared for release actually were tortured to death.
A few years later, however, four military whistleblowers came out. And now we are led to believe there is very good evidence that in fact those three men who were all cleared for release, they were all found innocent, they were all cleared for release, but they were tortured to death at a black site, possibly a CIA black site, at Guantanamo itself, called Camp No.
The White House, the Congress, the Pentagon, the CIA, the corporate military contractors are waging a worldwide reign of terror. After 9/11, we saw illegal kidnappings, torture, indefinite detention, And now we are seeing the drone strike, a continuation of this governmental lawlessness. Instead of capturing and detaining so-called enemies of the United States, the Pentagon and CIA now kills by remote control anyone it wants with impunity. And the new incoming CIA director, Mr. Brennan, is the architect of the so-called kill list. Disposition matrix is the next step in this policy of terror, which will involve conducting clandestine operations to kill anyone the U.S. suspects of being an enemy. This is the height of governmental lawlessness and criminality.
So much for rule of law in the United States when it becomes politically inconvenient. On the 11th of January, protesters supporting the First Nations Idle No More movement and opposing the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline showed up on the grounds of the Canadian Embassy for the second time in a week. One day after the tar sands blockades themselves spread to the pipeline route in Oklahoma, protesters smeared themselves with a tarry substance and staged a symbolic die-in on the steps of the Canadian Embassy. Idle No More, up in occupied Canada, is protesting two related issues. One is the tar sands mining project and other extractive industries destroying native land. The other related issue is Canada's Bill C-45, which is supposedly a budget and jobs bill, but included in it is proposals to sell off Native American land, known as First Nations land in Canada. No doubt one of the buyers would be the tar sands mining project itself. Also included is a revocation of waterway protections that otherwise would forbid polluting the water in the process of mining the tar sands. This is what Prime Minister Harper and the Canadian government call a jobs bill.
Obviously, this has everything to do with the XL pipeline. Some people here might not even know what is actually happening. And the thing is, this bill that has what has sparked Idle No More is a budget bill. That's exactly what it is. It's called a jobs and growth bill in Canada. And this has everything to do with Prime Minister Harper's termination process of Indigenous people and First Nations in Canada. In this bill, what it looks like is a 21st century land grab. It basically puts from 2.6 million waterways, lakes, and coastal regions under federal protection to 87, only 87 of those are now still under federal protection. And same with First Nations reserves. Now it is much, much easier to actually take more of their land. And this is all part of a larger process. process. Now, this is what, as Lacey said and everyone else here has said, that this is all part of the ruling class is just trying to take the land and profit off it.
The only thing is, climate scientists say if we burn the Alberta tar sands, it's game over for the climate. The kind of food shortages and famines, the total climate disruption that could result from burning the tar sands, possibly even a repeat of the Permian extinction nightmare, mean the TransCanada executives and the bankers really won't arrive in the next world very far behind the native people that they're killing with the tar sands mining project if they keep it up.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Last fall, the Occupy Wall Street movement unexpectedly spread from New York City's Zuccotti Park to hundreds of other encampments and protest sites across the U.S. and the world. The activists' condemnation of corporate greed, economic inequality, and the corrupting influence of money in politics resonated with millions of people around the globe, suffering through the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression early in the 20th century. To protest veterans and students of history, it was not surprising when this powerful new movement was the target of police repression. By late fall, local police commanders across the U.S. employed brutal tactics against Occupy activists better suited to confronting a terrorist threat than a group of citizens engaged in lawful and nonviolent peaceful protest. While police action effectively broke up most of the Occupy encampments, the movement's activities continue today, but much of it below the media radar. It was learned early on, through statements by Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan and an anonymous Justice Department source, that the FBI and U.S. Department of Homeland Security had helped coordinate local police actions suppressing the Occupy movement. Now a new batch of FBI documents, obtained by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund under the Freedom of Information Act, reveals the extent of government surveillance targeting Occupy and law enforcement agencies' collaboration with many of the same big banks targeted by Occupy Wall Street protests. Your reporter spoke with Heather Benno, staff attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who discusses her group's successful fight for the documents and what they reveal about the government's perception of the threat presented by the Occupy movement.
In these records, we see a vast surveillance involving the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the NCIC, and in addition, local police and private security or corporate security, or in other words, corporate interests, the very interests that the Occupy movement sought to expose as being problematic and related to the income disparity in the United States. So the records really span, they come from across the country. We had to press the FBI, which originally wanted to limit its search to its headquarters or central index. We had to press the FBI to actually release documents from field offices. So we got records from, you know, ranging from Alaska all the way to Florida, California, Arizona, and the East Coast. So we got about 100 records, just about over 100 pages of documents, and the documents are highly redacted. So there's a lot of information that we're still fighting to get. And it's clear from the documents that we have received that we haven't received the entirety of what the FBI actually has. So this is only one part of what we have done. We've already also received documents from the Department of Homeland Security, various productions, the National Park Service, which was involved in the law enforcement response here in Washington, D.C., and some very interesting responses from the CIA, which didn't actually produce records to us. So the take-home message from the FBI records that we recently received, some important information, was in essence, the fact that the FBI was working with private security and Wall Street-related interests, banking interests, even before the Occupy protests began.
That's interesting, and maybe you could talk more about that. What indications do we have that there were infiltrators involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement reporting on some of the early meetings that occurred before the first protest was launched in Zuccotti Park on September 19th, 2011, given the fact that your records indicate there were reports coming through the FBI in August of 2011?
Right. The earliest record that we received from the FBI was as early as August 19th, 2011, about a month before even one encampment was set up in Zuccotti Park in New York. And this was the FBI in New York meeting with the New York Stock Exchange, not ironically, to discuss the upcoming Occupy Wall Street protest. So already at that point, when the FBI had received information that there were to be some kind of political protest or organized First Amendment protected activity, not only was there monitoring going on, information collection, but that information was literally being turned over to those very interests that the protest movement stood against. And, you know, that was the beginning, but it's not the end of it all. We have records from Virginia, from Richmond, Virginia, from Anchorage, Alaska, from Biloxi, Mississippi, and other places where the FBI, in essence, because of certain legal restrictions on its ability to surveil First Amendment activity, was collecting information through proxies, in essence, working with the Federal Reserve, for example, in Richmond, Virginia, which had sent undercover or representatives without saying who they were to occupy meetings, and those representatives of the banks were then reporting that information back to the FBI.
When you look at all the surveillance that surrounded the Occupy Wall Street movement as it was growing around the country, do you see a deliberate and centralized government effort to surveil and eventually crack down and crush the movement? Or was this something that naturally grew out of the anti-terrorism enforcement agencies that were set up around the country looking for something to do? They have to justify their existence. So is it possible that their surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement grew out of the fact they needed to do something and they really had maybe nothing else on their plate?
You know, it's hard to speculate about their motivations, except for the fact that they were meeting with private interests, banking interests, and the very interests being protested, for example, the ports on the West Coast, throughout. So that would indicate not only that, you know, they're collecting information because they receive all of this money, all of this federal money. I mean, we've seen the congressional hearings and congressional reports on the fusion centers and essentially how much money they receive and where it's going. And these documents show that it really is truly going to fund a coordinated effort of collecting information on lawful protest movements. So they're collecting the information, and then what are they doing with it, though? Rather than, you know, using that information in some way to protect people, instead, the information is being used to protect Wall Street. So that indicates a certain allegiance and a certain, you know, strategy on the part of at least certain elements of federal law enforcement to protect Wall Street at the expense of regular working people.
That was Heather Benno, staff attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Find more information on the government's suppression and surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
The witch hunt against anarchists and Occupy activists by a Seattle grand jury continues to be one big fail. On the 3rd of January, Portland anarchist Carrie Cunneen refused to appear in a grand jury courtroom, announcing on January 9th that he would refuse to cooperate in any way with the grand jury. Two other activists, Matt and Tedio, have been in jail since September for refusing to snitch on fellow activists, and a third, Maddie Pfeiffer, was jailed a few weeks ago. Meanwhile, the blizzard of punitive attacks on capitalists for this grand jury and other police abuses continues. Portland, Oregon, 11th of January. Tires were slashed on six luxury cars, the attackers escaping by bicycle. This action was in solidarity with an activist accused of throwing a Molotov cocktail at a police car, as well as, quote, Carrie Cunin and all others throwing a wrench into the Seattle grand jury. Rochester, New York, 9th of January. A Lexus luxury car was trashed, and graffiti reading, Matt Pedio Matty, silent forever, and free packs were posted on a nearby bus stop. Hey, prosecutors and cops, had enough? If so, drop the Seattle grand jury investigation, withdraw all the subpoenas, and release Matty, Matt, and Kedio unconditionally and without charges.
Woke up this morning. You got yourself, yourself, yourself.
Fucking Democrats talking about gun control. Ask Anaheim pigs what them guns are for. First thing a dictatorship does, ban guns. First thing a real democracy do, ban drones. I'm a dreamer, wanna live in a world without guns popping. Not a world where only the cops got them. Wanna know where the US is headed? Look to Greece, where immigrants are terrorized by the fascist police. And when the shit hits the fan, they want you helpless, unable to defend yourself against state violence. Fuck that, if you ask me, it ain't about guns. It's about the way we fall beneath the cracks as the world turns. Alienation, hyper-individualism, death of communities, social service systems. Americans are stressed out, more so than the rest of the West. And the media is greedy, so they blow it up. Advertisement booms, and Wolf Blitzer might get a Pulitzer. This TV mass murder's out for fame. Why I wanna know Jake Holmes' name? They provide the oxygen for these toxic flames. News is for profit, the world is insane. It's what they did in Sweden. No more coverage in press, no mass deaths, no copycats lacking mental health. Go to Iraq, kill kids, that's fighting terror. Psychopath, go to school and slaughter kids, and it's murder. No logic, we celebrate Columbus Day. Violence is how the state treats poor community. This shit is close to my heart. My wife's a school teacher, and my homie saw Batman the opening night in Denver. Secondhand friends got that Jake Holmes treatment. In Iraq, 100,000 got that Jake Holmes treatment. I don't own a gun, but I'm hella glad so many of my homies have some. If you're being robbed in your home, the police won't come fast enough, and rapists won't rape no more if you blast them up. Yup. Stop looking for simple solutions to complex problems. There's 300 million of us in this country, and we are all alone. In this world, all you got is your problems, and the Facebook status update won't solve them. We're working more hours for less money. People living here got more stress than any Western country. Break down a community, family is a symptom of that. If your brain is a mess, we got Prozac for that. Modern psychiatry is little more than drug dealers. Only rich kids can afford it. This is a song about alienation, about a mental care system that don't address problems. Hyper-individualism, how capitalism turns men and women into nodes in a digital world where people don't talk no more. In the streets, people don't walk no more. Everyone's a zombie on a smartphone, playing military shoot 'em up games in the comfort of your home. I don't like guns, but I fired them before. But it ain't gonna fix what's sick. It's not like in the hood, folks are waiting 60 days for a license. You buy that shit hot and scrape off the serial numbers. What if in the 60s guns were banned? No beacon defense protecting blacks from the Ku Klux Klan. No Black Panthers, no civil rights, no enter British rule, no prospect for class war here. To the core, these are symptoms. Who do you blame when the killers are also the victims of a civilization in steep decline? We don't look out for you and yours. You're all alone. You're all alone. You're all alone. You're all alone.
You got yourself, 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 yourself. You got yourself, yourself, yourself. You got yourself, yourself, yourself.